It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at the sobering realities and root causes of poverty in our communities and how to end it for good. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Matthew Desmond says it's more socially acceptable today to disclose a mental illness than to tell someone you're broke. Call in with questions. Join the conversation along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew Desmond is a sociology professor at Princeton University. His book is Poverty by America. Matthew, welcome back to the Ideas Network and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Hey, Kate. It's an honor to be back on Wisconsin Public Radio and can't wait to be back in Wisconsin.
Well, let's talk about the book. You received a trajectory here. You received your doctorate at UW-Madison, moved to Milwaukee. That's where we get Evicted, the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, as you look at the role of evictions and poverty. So beyond evictions, what else are you hoping to help people understand about poverty?
That we don't have to live with it. You know, I think the biggest myth about poverty in America is that it's inevitable and we just have to deal with this situation today. And the situation is very bad. You know, 38 million of us can't afford basic necessities. If the poor in America founded a country, that country would be bigger than Australia. It'd be bigger than Venezuela. And so this is a problem that we've created. And this is a problem that we can finally abolish. I think that's the fundamental message of this book. We can and should abolish poverty in this land of abundance.
How is poverty experienced differently or the same in Wisconsin versus elsewhere in the country?
You know, living in Milwaukee, in the mobile home park right by the airport, in a rooming house on the north side of the city, taught me a lot about really critically desperate poverty in America. You know, I met grandmothers living without heat in trailers, you know, getting by under blankets and praying that the space heaters didn't go out. I see kids routinely evicted, you know, when I was living in Milwaukee. It was just part of the everyday fabric of the city. And I think that those kind of experiences really drove this question of why inside of me. You know, why is there so much poverty in this land of dollars? And poverty is experienced is not just a lack of income, but it's experienced as this exhausting piling on of problems. You know, it's tooth rot on top of, you know, having to tell your kids they can't have seconds, on top of the nauseating fear of eviction, homelessness, pain, physical pain, death come early and often. So it's not a line, you know, it's this tight knot of social problems. And I think that should spur us to real moral action.
You say the word the line, the poverty line. How does the federal government define poverty and deep poverty?
So the poverty line was invented during the war on poverty. You know, when Lyndon Johnson launched that war in 1964, he needed a metric about how to measure it. And so someone in the Social Security Administration came up with this idea that if poverty is not having basic necessities, and the most basic of basic things is food, then what you could do is you could calculate a poverty line by saying if food takes more than a third of your budget, you're poor because you just don't have enough for that money to stretch to other things. And that's kind of the original poverty line. And that's kind of continued over the years. Social scientists have raised a lot of problems with that line. And, you know, we've kind of invented new measures and new metrics to measure poverty. But, you know, a lot of those metrics are still, you know, showing deep hardship in America today.
Why is that line invented, you know, decades ago? Why is it problematic? You know, why isn't it serving us?
Well, one thing that it doesn't do very well is count government aid. You know, and so there's a lot of programs that go into people's lives, like food stamps and housing assistance. And the official poverty measure doesn't account for those. It also doesn't account for cost of living. So if you're making $25,000 in upstate New York and $25,000 in LA, those are different experiences. But the poverty line doesn't really pay attention to those. So in 2011, the government launched a new kind of poverty line. It was called the Supplemental Poverty Measure, and it did account for cost of living expenses, and it did account for these kind of government aid. And when we did that, we actually gained 3 million more poor people in America, because any reductions in poverty by counting things like food stamps were more than offset by paying attention to rising housing and medical costs. And, you know, even if we want to kind of quibble and debate with how poverty is measured, there's still real troubling signs of hardship. So since 2000, eviction filings have increased by 22%. Since that time, the share of families visiting food pantries has increased by 19%. You know, since the Great Recession, the number of public school kids in America who are homeless has increased by over 74%. Mm. These are indicators that should really trouble us and show us that there's a lot of Americans experiencing deep hardship today.
We're talking with author and sociologist Matthew Desmond. New book is Poverty by America. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. George in Milwaukee. Hi, George. What would you like to share?
Yeah, well, I'm here in Milwaukee, and I've run food pantries and meal programs for over 20 years. And I have my perspective on what I think, you know, the problems are, why there's so much root causes of poverty. And I just was wondering what he feels like maybe the top two or three reasons are.
George, thank you. Appreciate your perspective. Matthew.
Why is there so much poverty in America? Because many of us benefit from it. This is by design. Many of us consume the cheap goods and services the working poor produce. Many of us are invested in the stock market. Don't we benefit when we see our returns going up, even when those returns come at a human sacrifice? Many of us get tax breaks from the government, and we don't see those as welfare, but, you know, they cost the government money and they put money in our pocket. And the welfare state in America is completely imbalanced. We give the most to families that need it the least. We do a lot more to subsidize affluence and fight poverty. And then we have the audacity to ask, how could we afford to do more? And then, as George knows, living in one of the most segregated cities in the country, we continue to be segregated. And many of us continue to build walls around our community and hoard affluence and wealth behind those walls. And that concentrates privilege, but it also concentrates poverty. The reason there's so much poverty in America is not in spite of our wealth, but because of it.
Let's put a face on it. You wrote about a Milwaukee resident using the pseudonym Crystal Mayberry. Why is Crystal's story indicative of life in poverty?
Because Crystal shows how just deeply hard poverty in America can be. Just to summarize her story real quick, you know, she was born when her mom was stabbed in the back, the attack-induced labor. Her mom and her dad fought a lot. It wasn't the first time her mom had been assaulted. When Crystal was five, she ended up in foster care, bounced between, you know, foster homes. The longest she lived, if anyone, was 5 years when she lived with her aunt, and then her aunt returned her. You know, then the longest she lived anywhere was 8 months. You know, when she was 16, she dropped out of high school. She started getting in fights with other girls at the group home. She aged out of foster care when she was 18. She couldn't access housing assistance, so she rented her first apartment on the north side of Milwaukee in a very poor neighborhood, but it still took 73% of her income. Mm. She soon got evicted, and on and on and on the story goes, one problem after another, and Crystal finally descended into street homelessness, you know, just a very young woman. And I think that when you look at someone like Crystal, you're faced with the fact that poverty is such a deeply, deeply destabilizing and painful process. And I think that we have become too tolerant of this in America. We've come to see it as part of us. We have to come to see poverty as an abomination. You know, Crystal didn't deserve that. You know, poverty reduces people born for better things.
George in Milwaukee, I see that you're still there. Does that resonate with you in the work that you do with meal programs and food pantries?
I mean, yeah, it does resonate with me. I mean, when I'm looking at root causes of poverty, I mean, like, to me, one of the number one reasons is because people aren't self-sufficient because of a lack of education. And, you know, it's evident if you go into the richer areas of the greater Milwaukee, you know, you have a high graduation rate compared to in the urban city of Milwaukee, and it's because kids aren't benefiting with a great education so that they can be self-sufficient. I mean, we have lots of other reasons. We have, as he talked about with the segregation, we have the horrible problem with black male incarceration rate. We have double the rate in the state of Wisconsin than the national average. So there's just so many outlying causes. But I always come back to education.
George, thank you. As you talk about those compounding issues, we have Princeton University sociologist Matthew Desmond dissecting all the facets of poverty, the myths about being poor, and how to put an end to it. Solutions. The book is Poverty by America. There is space to talk here. Call in with your question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is a question that haunts sociologist Matthew Desmond. Why is there so much poverty in our country, one of the richest countries in the world? We dig into that question, explore solutions to end poverty, and you can join in the discussion and share thoughts. Call in with your question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Matthew Desmond's book is Poverty by America. Let's bring in Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, what would you like to bring up?
I know a lot of people who, when they talk about poverty, they talk about people as though they refuse to work or they refuse to make their own lives better. And this conversation goes on in public life, in our politics, where people basically don't want mixed housing close to where they live. And the implication is that the poor are dangerous people to be around. And what I find odd about that is, if we're going to say that America is a place where you gotta step up, the rungs on the ladder, we're going to have to associate with the poor and bring them into communities where the work is and where they can improve their lives. I'm just seeking comment on that,
Rich,
kind of phenomenon that's widespread in America.
Rich, appreciate the perspective. Matthew Desmond, go ahead.
Yeah, Rich is onto something. I think that if we're going to be a country that embraces freedom and embraces economic opportunity, we can't have our values stop where our property line begins. Segregation continues to be a leading cause of poverty. And so those of us that are living in areas surrounded by walls, areas that refuse to allow any kind of affordable housing to go through, we need to take a stand against that. We need to turn away from segregation and start reaching for broad, open community. And I got to say, when we do, we get something. We get something. There's studies that show that when affordable housing is blending into the community well-managed, it has no effect on property values. And just beyond our bottom line monetarily, I think that we get a freer, safer, happier country. I've lived in a lot of neighborhoods, including very poor neighborhoods. And the times I lived in those neighborhoods, I was met with a lot of generosity, a lot of neighborliness that's very hard to find in some affluent communities in America. So I do think for us to really tackle this challenge, things do have to change. But what we get in exchange is something like our restored humanity.
I want to look a little more closely at jobless benefits. Republicans in one chamber of our state legislature recently approved a series of bills that would tighten access to unemployment insurance and saying jobless people would return to the workforce more quickly. What is your perception? Because I think you disagree that American workforce shortages are being caused by welfare dependency.
Let's look at the data. If you look in the data and you ask how big of a problem welfare dependency is, and social scientists like me have been asking that question for over 50 years, the answer is there's very little evidence of it. And if you study the data, you learn that the bigger problem is welfare avoidance. The fact that billions, and I'm talking billions with a B, of dollars are left on the table every year in unused aid. You know, if you look at the money left on the table because families that qualify for food stamps don't take them and qualify for unemployment insurance and the earned income tax credit, this kind of 1 year bump for our poorest paid workers, and some of our biggest anti-poverty programs, you learn that every year $142 billion is left on the table. This is not a picture of welfare dependency. This is a picture of us doing a terrible job of connecting families to programs that would alleviate their hunger and help their kids. And the fact that some of our elected officials want to make it harder for those families to get access to those life-saving programs is sinful, and it's completely out of touch with the lived experience of poverty today. I would encourage those lawmakers to actually get in relationship with some of their constituents that are struggling today, listen to them. And I would encourage them to spend a day in the welfare office and realize how utterly difficult it is to access these programs already. We should be making it just as easy for kids to access, you know, food programs than it is for me to order birdseed or mouthwash on my phone through Amazon.
Princeton University sociology professor Matthew Desmond with us. New book is Poverty by America. Let's bring in Scott in Green Lake. Scott, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm a Wisconsin resident, but recently moved from Minnesota. And question I have, and maybe you answered it, is I feel like, you know, MnCare is a healthcare benefit for people below the poverty line, and it seems like a pretty good program. So I thought you might comment on things like that possibly. Yeah. Thank you.
Scott, thank you. And bringing up MnCare and what it is like to be below the poverty line in our neighbor, Minnesota.
Right. I mean, the real question of Scott is who's his football allegiance with? You know, I think that's the real question. Look, I think that, you know, one of the biggest problems that are facing poor Americans, especially poor elderly Americans, is rising healthcare costs. And, you know, rising healthcare costs is something that we've had to spend a lot more money to get our handle on. And this is kind of something that suggests a bigger problem in America that, you know, we haven't been able to fix the fundamentals of the country that have been cracking over the last 50 years. The fact that the job market isn't delivering for a lot of American workers, the fact that the housing market is utterly brutal for renting families, and the fact that healthcare costs are skyrocketing in America and are much higher than in other peer societies and countries. And so things like MnCare and Medicaid, or in the working situation, things like tax breaks for poor paid workers, or housing vouchers for low-income renting families, those things are essential and helpful, but we also have to start reaching for longer-term solutions. We need to not just triage the problem. We need to really attack the disease.
And you say merely placing money in people's wallets falls short of addressing poverty. Why would poverty continue even after strategies like expanded tax credits or boosting the minimum wage?
Because we have to wrap those incentives and those kind of programs around with programs that address the unrelenting exploitation of the poor. So if you look at studies on the minimum wage, when minimum wages are increased in cities, renters have an easier time paying the rent for a little while. And then the rents slowly catch up to that wage bump, diluting and even kind of washing out sometimes the benefit. We saw this in COVID, right? We saw workers actually get a raise. There was kind of there was wage inflation, economists call it. And so for the first time in a long time, a lot of poorly paid workers actually got money in their pocket. But then what happened? Well, rents went up 11% nationwide. That was the highest on record. And so if we don't also address the kind of ways that the poor are forced to pay more, then I think any incentives to just increase the floor are going to be diluted at best and canceled out at worst. So we need to absolutely make deeper investments in poor families in America, but we also need different strategies that really try to lift people out of poverty and keep them out.
What effect does inflation have on poor families as the Federal Reserve raises interest rates?
It's massively impactful. You know, poor families are consuming basic goods, right? Housing, food, utilities, and these have increased faster than just normal rates of inflation. So it's incredibly painful, and the poor shouldn't be told to take the hard medicine for this. You know, we're kind of acting like we can't make these deep investments in the American public without, you know, facing the inflation side effect. But look, if you just look at other countries with a lot less poverty that make a lot deeper investments, they're not in this situation. And so we need to ask ourselves what's going on. And when I look at the data, what I see is, you know, in the 40 years before COVID,
very quickly,
labor costs accounted for most of inflation. But during COVID, corporate profits accounted for that. So I think we need to look at profiting more than kind of what deep investments have done for inflation.
Matthew Desmond, and we'll pick this up. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and sociologist Matthew Desmond, who studies poverty up close in Milwaukee in Evicted and is out with a new book, Poverty by America, examining what accounts for our lack of progress on ending poverty. And you can join in your thoughts. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Patrick in Winona, Minnesota. Patrick, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Thanks for having the show.
Sure, yes.
My question would be, I think it's a pretty good illustration of just how ignorant a lot of people are because of those who are watching this, and not like a slight like ignorant, but intentionally brought about that people are going to watch the show and be like, oh my goodness, that's terrible. But these things have been ingrained into our civilizations for a long time. And I'm not sure what it is that what the solution is, the catalyst that's going to cause change. Where's the working model of this system where we don't have poor people that are meant to be kept poor? And I guess I'll take my question off the air.
Patrick, thank you for turning to solutions. Matthew.
We have a child poverty rate that's twice the rate of Canada, South Korea, or Germany. We are the richest country in the world with the worst poverty. There's just no advanced industrial society that has the kind of poverty that we have, the level of poverty that we have. And so I think that we can't view our poverty as something that we have to endure. We have to view it as something strange about America and also something that's utterly fixable. You know, when the War on Poverty and the Great Society were launched in 1964, Congress was a mess. It was divided. We were anti-democratic. In fact, senators were filibustering reform, sleeping in their offices. It looked a lot like Congress looks today. But even when we were so divided and so polarized, we got these big pieces of legislation and we got these big civil rights laws. And the War on Poverty and Great Society cut poverty in half in 10 years. We have made progress on these issues, and we've made progress in COVID. You know, through the child tax credit, which was just a subsidy to low and moderate income families with those kids, that cut child poverty by 46% in 6 months. So we know how to do this. We have the resources how to do this. Now we need to build the political will to start advocating for this as our new normal. We want to end poverty in America. I think that's what we should be demanding of our leaders.
Digging in more deeply with numbers, you say the magic number to abolishing poverty in the U.S. is $177 billion. How did you come up with that figure?
So this is a rough estimate, but it's a thought exercise. It basically asks, okay, if you take everyone below the poverty line and say this person needs $1,000 to rise above the line, wow, this person is really struggling. They need, you know, $15,000 to raise above the poverty line. And you kind of add all that up. You get this figure, you get $177 billion a year to lift everyone below the official poverty line above it. And that sounds like a big, big figure. But, you know, a study published a few years ago showed that if the top 1% of Americans just paid the taxes they owed, not got taxed more, just stopped evading taxes so successfully, we could raise, as a nation, $175 billion a year. You know, we could just about lift everyone out of poverty if the richest among us just paid their fair share. And so I think for me, it was important to raise that issue to drive home the fact that we could absolutely do this. We are a country of abundant resources, and we have to reject this scarcity lie that we can't afford to do more.
So you're saying if rich people would pay their fair share of taxes, we could almost wipe out poverty in America? Put a finer point on that.
Sure. So, you know, we are in a political debate right now about the debt ceiling, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. we have a conversation about we just can't afford this spending. And Wisconsin has had these debates for a long time. You know, we can't afford to provide more families safe, affordable housing. We can't afford to provide everyone in America with a doctor. And when I hear this question, how could we afford it? I just feel it's such a sinful, dishonest question. We could afford it if the richest among us took less from the government. We could afford it if our nation was designed to fight poverty and not just to guard fortunes. So if we want to put a real fine point on this, what I'm talking about is tax fairness. I'm talking about making sure all of us pay our fair share. And I'm talking about rebalancing the safety net to make sure that our safety net is designed for families that are most vulnerable and most in need, instead of the design now, where, you know, most of the benefits go to families that have plenty already. Let me just give you one quick stat, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
So the top 20% of American families on average receive about $35,000 a year from the government in tax breaks, in social insurance programs, in means-tested programs. But the bottom 20% of Americans, that average family, our poorest families, they only receive $25,000 a year in those benefits. That's almost a 40% difference. That's the imbalance I'm talking about. And so I would like us as a country to bring us more back into balance, to actually fight and strive for broad prosperity instead of the idea that the rich just get richer.
So you're saying that the biggest beneficiaries of federal aid are these affluent families, that middle and upper class families are also dependent on government programs.
Yeah, we have to face that fact. And, you know, let's just look at housing. You know, in 2020, the nation spent $53 billion a year on direct housing assistance to the needy. These is like things like public housing, a housing voucher that reduces a family's rent. So $53 billion. But that same year, we spent $193 billion on homeowner tax subsidies, things like the mortgage interest deduction. Most of that subsidy flowed to families with six-figure incomes. You know, we have to face the fact that a 15-story public housing complex and a mortgage suburban home in Wauwatosa are both government subsidized, but just one looks and feels that way. And I think once we start looking at how the government is in our lives, I think we can start talking about the ways that we have benefited from government largesse and how those benefits often flow to families that really don't need a hand. We often talk about redistribution when we have this conversation. I don't really like that word. Mm-hmm. I'm not really talking about
redistribution
that.
Of wealth, you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm basically talking about those of us that are benefiting from this imbalanced welfare state. I think we could take a stand against that. We could say, look, I want to be a poverty abolitionist. And that means that maybe I can think of, man, I don't really need this mortgage tax deduction. I don't really need this tax break for this wealth transfer. You know, is it really fair that I get a tax break for saving for college, when basically the only folks that can do that are really privileged families in America? Let's start talking about those taxes and those benefits like this.
Princeton sociologist Matthew Desmond, new book, Poverty by America. Let's bring in Mike in Shell Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Yes, I kind of want to change my subject, my comment a little bit. He's talking about people not paying their fair share of taxes. And while I am by no means rich, I mean, I'm below the poverty line myself, 52% of this country pays little to no taxes. So the top people are paying their fair share. And I just don't get that. And we are not the wealthiest nation on earth. We are the most indebted nation on earth. We can't, I mean, it'd be nice to scoop everybody up and give everybody an equal shot, but it's just, life doesn't work that way. Sometimes you just don't make it. And I do manage a local food shelf, a lot of people that come in are drug addicted. There's mental health issues, and we gotta focus on that in a big way before we can fix anything else.
Mike, appreciate you calling in. Yes, thank you, Matthew.
So Mike is repeating a familiar talking line, which is about the non-taxpaying class. And what he's referring to is the fact that a good chunk of Americans don't pay much income tax after the standard deduction. But Mike, that's like counting calories only by counting what you had for breakfast. You got to look at lunch, dinner, and that ice cream you had after too. And when you look at all the taxes people pay, sales tax, income tax, Social Security taxes, the poorest Americans' real tax rate is basically the same as the richest Americans' real tax rate. We basically have kind of this kind of flat tax in America if you look at everything folks are paying, and it's worse. You know, the actual tax break for the richest Americans has fallen over the past several years, but it's risen for working class, middle class, and poor families. This is absurd. And so I think when we talk about tax fairness, we have to talk about the fact that a lot of big corporations and the wealthiest families are doing a lot of shenanigans to not pay what they are required to. And this really matters. This means we don't have enough to go around to provide adequate housing. So we evict kids by the millions every year. This means the richest country needs to, you know, abide by hunger and homelessness and deprivation and desperation. And we are rich, Mike. We are. Our economy is bigger than the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth biggest economies in the world. You know, during COVID, Americans bought over 300,000 power boats. One in eight of us own a second home. This is a country that has a lot of abundance. And what I'm calling for is for us to share that abundance. We as a nation once used to talk about ourselves like this. We used to be swashbuckling and ambitious about wanting to abolish poverty in America. And I want us to rekindle that sense of ambition and that sense of moral urgency. We can do this.
Princeton University sociology professor Matthew Desmond's book is Poverty by America, and still time to explore your questions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Almost one in nine Americans living in poverty. Sociologist Matthew Desmond guides us on how we can become what he calls poverty abolitionists and end poverty now. The new book is called Poverty by America. Let's bring in Jeremy in Racine. Jeremy, what are your thoughts?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In regards to providing an income for people who are impoverished, tried this before in other forms, welfare.
And Jeremy, it's really hard to hear you because I think there's a lot of car jostling. Try again.
So we've done this before in the past in regards to welfare systems, housing assistance, food assistance, income assistance, medical assistance, and it hasn't worked in the past. So I'm not understanding why it would start to work all of a sudden now. And there's an old saying, you give a man a fish, he eats for the day. You teach the man how to fish, he eats for a lifetime. So I think that we need to better educate people, provide better education, provide skills to allow them to provide for themselves instead of just giving them money. Because if you keep giving them money, there's not going to be any accountability how they spend the money, do they spend it wisely, things like that. It always...
Jeremy, thank you. Matthew, go ahead.
I'm so tired of these cliches about the poor. You know, who's asking me how I'm spending my mortgage interest deduction? Who's asking you, Jeremy, how you're spending your money? None of us are doing it on our own. We are all connected. A lot of us get help, either from our parents, but also from the government. you know? And if we're poor, that help might come in food stamps. But if we're rich, that help might come in wealth tax breaks or the mortgage interest deduction. I think we have to face up to this fact and reject this idea that there's a part of us that just can all do it on our own. We're all connected here. And look, you're wrong. There's a mountain of evidence that shows that housing assistance, food stamps are lifesavers to the families. These things work. The reason that they haven't abolished poverty is we have underdosed the problem. It's like giving a cancer patient to Advil and then asking why it doesn't work. Only 1 in 4 families who qualifies for any kind of housing assistance in America receives it. And the majority of those families are poor and are left out in the private market and have to pay at least half of their income to housing assistance. So it's just not true that these programs don't work. And it's also just not true that the poor are the only ones that are dependent on help from the government. We all are connected. And I think once we realize that, we can kind of see that we're part of this shared reality and that often sometimes our gains come at their losses. And I want to divest from that. I want to become a poverty abolitionist and turn away from exploitation and also just turn away from these old stories we've told ourselves again and again, which aren't true.
Let's turn to segregation. The last chapter is about desegregating cities between rich and poor. How can cities reduce that financial segregation, and what would that mean?
Well, for families that are kept out of neighborhoods of high opportunity, for families that are pressed and forced to live in neighborhoods shoulder to shoulder with other poor families, to go to schools where most of the kids are coming from poor neighborhoods, to be in neighborhoods that struggle with public safety, for those families, it would mean a whole different life. You know, it would be finally being able to breathe. It would be an opening it up to the nation, to them, to the opportunity that this nation offers. So it would mean a lifesaver. So how do we do that? Well, you know, on most residential land in America, it's illegal to build anything other than a single detached family home. And this is a recipe for segregation, economic and racial segregation. You know, there may be no more boring, soulless word in the English language than municipal zoning ordinance. But man, that's a good way to look at the soul of a community. That's the wall that many of us build around our communities. And we have to tear down the wall. We have to replace exclusionary zoning ordinances with inclusionary ones. Exclusionary zoning ordinances say, look, you can't build anything other than a single detached family home in this community. And the best inclusionary zoning ordinances say, nope, you gotta diversify the kind of housing stock that's in this community. And I think that that sounds like a policy idea, right? But it's actually a personal call. It's a moral call that I'm making, you know, because modern day segregationists have done the tedious work of maintaining the wall. They go to zoning board meetings, they gum up the process, they yell at the aldermen on a Tuesday night. And for those of us that are seeking a more open, inclusive community, we need to go to zoning board meetings too. We need to start petitions too. And we need to stand up and say, look, I refuse to be a segregationist. I refuse to deny kids opportunities my kids get by living here. Let's build this thing.
Let's bring in Dennis in Afton, Minnesota. Dennis, what's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. Thanks to the morning show, WPR and Matthew. Someone figured it out, in my opinion. Thanks for doing it. I once saw a T-shirt that said, figure it out. Our situations that we have, they're not by mistakes. They're not mistakes. They're designed. And the war in Iraq was not a mistake, like somebody said, like maybe a president said. It was designed, not a three-week war, and went on to destroy the civilization. And we've got an empire, 800 military bases in 80 countries. And the fact is, the rich need people in poverty to join the military so they can step up and supposedly improve their life as many come back physically and mentally ruined. I mean, it's not by chance that the military funding took place 2 months ago with $850 billion again, 2 months before the debate on the national debt. You know, we need to give attention to what George Washington stated. Three things can bring down a young country: extreme partisanship, excessive spending, and warring around the world. I think he had it right. Martin Luther King Day in 024, I'm recommending that we get on his priority concern at the end of his life, and that was poverty and the military situation.
Dennis, thank you. I want to turn back to Matthew here. Go ahead.
Dennis makes an important point where we do have a large military budget, and, you know, the military is often disproportionately staffed by folks from poor and working class families, especially from rural America. It's also true that we spend twice as much on tax breaks every year than we do on the military. And I think that if we're asking for a rebalancing, if we're asking for deeper investments in economic opportunity, and we're asking where that comes from, where the pay for comes from, I think part of the answer has to be from us, you know, and I think it starts a process where we can build the political will. So, you know, next time tax season rolls around, maybe instead of, you know, leaning over the fence of the neighbor and complaining about taxes, maybe we have a more awkward conversation about how we get these tax breaks that we don't really need and start trying to change the common sense of the priorities in America that are reflected in the federal budget, not only in the military spending, but also in the spending on affluent communities.
As we leave here, you've mentioned being a poverty abolitionist. I'm wondering, what are some changes we can make today, now, in our own lives to become one?
I love this question. I'm going to give you five concrete things.
Go for it.
One, you can start where you are. Everyone has a little bit of power wherever they are. And we can ask in our faith community, in our jobs, in our school boards, what are we doing to divest from poverty here? The second thing we can do, we can shop differently and we can invest differently. You know, we can have solidarity with the poor in where we spend our money. Third, we can talk about taxes differently. We could really start to question how we are connected to the government's largesse. And maybe we start a letter campaign asking for some of these tax breaks to be wound down if we don't need them. Fourth, let's go to that zoning board meeting. Let's get there, folks. And let's stand up and do our part to really break down the walls of segregation. And number five, we can join an anti-poverty movement. And there are so many wonderful ones around the country. And if you're looking to connect, I've got a website called endpovertyusa.org. So endpovertyusa.org. And you can find amazing anti-poverty groups in Wisconsin and around the country putting in the work to fight for a better, freer, safer country.
Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It was really an honor to be back on the Ideas Network.
Matthew Desmond is a sociology professor at Princeton University. His book is called Poverty by America. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.